young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do.
Say Dawn Kazarian with us. She is the co-author of Married to the Enemy, A Guide to Overcoming the Obstacles to Intimacy When We're Raised in a Culture That Uses Sexism and Stereotyping to Divide Us. As a matter of fact, she is a licensed mental health counselor, nationally board certified, has a private practice in Indianapolis, and specializes in couples work. She's had an interest in the impact of sexism and stereotyping on children, couples, and our society for many, many years now. Dawn, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. What was it about this particular subject? And when we're dealing with not necessarily married to the enemy, but the difference between the genders as opposed to behavior, etc. No, I guess that's the same thing, isn't it? Where was it that triggered you to look at this issue and bring it to the fore?
It's not atypical, according to my mother, having grown up when, having raised her children when she did in the 50s and 60s, that, you know, how women were treated, of course, was less. I mean, we still hadn't had the right even to be on jury duty until the, I think it was later 50s. So having watched the power struggling between her and my father, I think even as a child, I was interested in why this existed and why he was treated as such a privileged person. And so, you know, going forward and getting married myself at age 25 and then watching that marriage slip away, and it seemed to me that often our problems seem to stem from mistaken gender beliefs, and one of those being that I would be treated as less, as somebody who was not worthy of being heard or needs it were as important as his. So figuring other people have this problem too, that's when I first thought of I need to write a book, because we start out with such good intentions, and I know he started out with good intentions too, but we live in a society. What Mark and I do is we try to point the finger not at each other but at the culture. Sure. And at society. Because we live in a society that, you know, if you consider how disrespectful and sexist Howard Stern is,
Dawn, wait, and with all due respect here, yes, Howard Stern is that way. There's no question about it. But there's women that way too today. I don't quite understand.
Absolutely. Yes.
How it's morphed.
I don't disagree with that.
Yeah. And now, by the way, the other side of this, which I think is interesting more than anything else, we're dealing with a culture that is so different than the 50s and 60s. I was brought up in the 50s. I was born in the early 40s, and I, grammar school, junior high school, my formative years was in the 50s, and it was a completely different world in those days. And yes, the women weren't treated as they had the strength as men, but we've come to this age now that there isn't anything, any door that won't open to a woman, and I don't quite understand where the gender problem is today.
Well, it's not with women. When I go to the bookstore and I see five bookshelves in the gender studies section, but I only see one shelf aiming its studies at men, I'm concerned, because we have statistics that show that it's not children that shoot up our schools, but that it's boys. Yeah. And we have statistics that says that our boys and young men are five times more likely to commit suicide than our females. And we have statistics that show that 87% of our prisons are made up of men. And I don't think, you know, that's biology. I don't think that men are by nature that aggressive. You know, that's not. But we do have a media system. We have a society that promotes aggression more so than it does.
Oh, no question. But that aggression is—it was both genders. My goodness, I've seen on news. I've seen girls 14, 15 years old that I don't remember fights that violent and vicious when I was a kid. That I mean, double their fists.
Yes.
They're hurting each other. That stems from what I truly believe in, and I don't even know if it's gender anymore. But look at that. Look at the movies that we see. There's nothing that an 8 or 9 year old isn't exposed to today. Completely. Look at the violence in the video games. I mean, this goes on and on and on. And there's models there that shouldn't really be. And that's what I think a lot of the kids model after. If they don't get it at home, they're going to move outwardly and they're going to take on those personas that they think is going to be acceptable to their peer groups.
And I would agree with that we do see girls becoming more aggressive. But that still speaks to my point, which is girls have been able to cross the gender line. Boys have not. And when we get boys comfortable with the idea that they are emotional feeling beings and that they don't make these attachments to, if I feel, well, then I'm going to be like, I'm going to be whipped. I'm going to be like a girl. You know, Mark is incredibly honest throughout the book of, you know, the thought processes that he's gone through. And John Gottman, a leading expert in couple relationship, his research is just within the past decade where he demonstrates that we have 65% of our men who will not take influence by their wives. And power in a relationship is influence. So both the man and the female have to be influenced.
Don, you've also got a 60% divorce rate going on now. Now, I want to back up what you say, and I want to take you all the way back to the 1964-1967. Susie Greenman loves this one when I pull it out, but this is exemplifying what you're saying. I have the Milk and Ice Cream Drivers and Dairy Employers Union Local 225, their dairy and ice cream agreement, okay? On page 77, Article 15, it says the employer shall not employ female help on any identical operation is now performed or hereto performed by male help. Period. End. So that verifies and validates what you're saying. There was a time that obviously is not that bad today, but there was a time that women were put in particular places. Let's go to the Arab nations right now. Women just got the right to vote. Now, they still can't drive and they can't be out in public without a man there. So we've got that in the world, but we don't have anywhere near that here in this country.
Well, when you have 65%, and now I don't want to negate the 35% that do take influence from their wives, you're just going to have a problem with communication. And we do, as you pointed out, we have a high divorce rate. If you're not able to take influence from each other. And the problem with, you know, and when it comes to communication, there is no gender difference. You know, good communication is good communication, that one actively listens and that one asserts themselves and one knows how to forgive. And that's not gender related, that's just good communication. But how does one actively listen if they're resisting influence? And so I know in both of my marriages there was a resistance to influence, and I don't think either one of them wanted to do that. But what you have is, again, a society and a culture that supports. Boys will attach, as will girls. When we're growing up, we attach to a belief system. If a boy is put down by being called a girl, the very sex that he wants to later hook up with, you know, that's going to give him some pretty mixed messages. So if he's showing sensitivity, if he's showing vulnerability, and he's called a girl, which, you know, as far as I know, you don't get that in the girl groups where they put down each other by calling them a boy.
No, they're trying too hard to become boys. I've been watching what's been going on in the last 10 or 15 years, and when we talk about equality, by the way, if feminism is the equality of opportunity, I'm right there. I'm a feminist. But if it's the subjugation of man to get yourself ahead, I'm totally on the opposite side of the table. Dawn, I've watched over the years.
Of course.
And the youngsters, you know, it's especially the boys, they get quote unquote beaten over the head. You've got to be sensitive. You got to go do this. If you open your mouth, you got to go to a class. And I have watched the kids today. The girls have gotten more masculine, and the boys in general have become more feminist or feminine.
I would say we're not looking at a strong. We need individuals who are strong. Would you agree? And loving, courageous, responsible, cooperative, in order to survive in a democratic society. Would you say that's accurate?
Absolutely. I would not disagree in any way, shape, or form. I just in today's world, I've been exposed to a tremendous amount of people, not just one or two or ten couples, etc. And they've got some background of behavior. And when it really comes down to it, I don't see it that exaggerated today. I don't see the male standing up and saying, "I'm a male, you're a woman, you'd be subservient." In this day and age, that would be destructive.
Right. And Mark talks about, though, how this, you know, as far as he was concerned, he would find himself being passive aggressive with it in order to try to get his ends met, which, you know, was to have more control and domination, I suppose. But that, you know, I think to me the bottom line is this: we have, it's not an innate problem, as far as I know, as to why our males commit suicide in those numbers compared to our females. And I just looked at the 2007 statistics, and we're still at a much higher rate for males to females. And to me, that's got to suggest that men aren't equipped to be able to express themselves, to be able to be connected to their emotions other than anger, because we have a plethora of, you know, violent media system aimed at our boys more so than the females. But yes, the females cross that line because that's the accepted line to cross. And you know, I think there's higher sources at play here too. I mean, just if you read some of the like Fire in the Belly, some of the books aimed at, written by men for men, you know, they talk about, you know, we've got to have a slew of ready-made army people in order to protect society. And so I think that's a part of it. That's behind it, too. But, you know, I hear what you're saying, that it seems like the boys have become softer and the girls have become more aggressive.
No, my ex-wife, she probably still is, and she's a wonderful woman, and we get along great. We still talk. But she was a runner. And I remember that I went to the university with her, and she was a distance runner. I'm not. And so she was getting her numbers or whatever the case may be, signing up. And there were two youngsters, probably 18 to 20 years old, sitting behind the desk at the university, and they were handing out the applications to run. And one kid said to the other, "Well, my person dropped me off, and where are you and your person going out today?" Well, there's no more boys and girls. There's no more men and women. You know, they've come down to persons. And there is definitely two genders. The emotions are different. And I think women, for the most part, quote unquote, get more lap time and nurturing by mom than the boys do. And there's going to be a little bit of a difference. But the culture in and of itself, I think they put a hammer down on a lot of these young men.
You think they put a hammer down on a lot of these young men? What do you mean?
You have to be this
way. The hammer represents.
The hammer represents rules, regulations. If you're not this way, that, you know, you're a sexist. Take it to politics. If you're not this way, you're a racist. By using these titles, it controls people. And there's a lot of kids today that really don't have their voice because they're stifled, boys and girls. But I've watched girls get tougher, and I've watched boys back off and back off and back off. And the thinking is completely different today.
Well, what's wrong with having those rules in place? I'm a little confused. Isn't it okay to have rules in place where we don't say hateful things?
Why force me as a man to respect somebody that I shouldn't be respecting? It's got nothing to do with men and women. It's got to do with human beings and people. If you get some, by the way, I have a tremendous prejudice, but the prejudice isn't color. It's consciousness. I won't let some white people into my house. But what it comes down to is we're putting everybody in a group, and we're saying that, okay, you boys are like this, and you have to be sensitive to what the girls want. And if you open your mouth now, you're sexist and you can't speak. That's really what's coming out of all of this.
Well, I think if it's done as harshly as what you're describing, I think that would be a problem. But I heard you say that you value respect. And yeah. So where's the respect? You know, do you really think in this society that we could have a female counterpart to Howard Stern and have her become popular?
No, by the way, that's Howard Stern. That's one man and 300 million people in this country. And that, by the way,
but
Howard Stern is paid for doing that. Don, he gets paid for being that way. He's not going to change. Why would
right,
he?
Right, but what in Sirius Radio's ratings went up. They skyrocketed after he was hired on in 2004. I think that
absolutely
says something in that we're a society, and I think that 65% that John Gottman studied, I mean, I'm not sure what pocket of the world you're coming from where you're looking at it being.
No, wait a minute. I don't watch The View. Do you hear what I'm saying? You know, you're saying that the Howard Stern's ratings skyrocketed. Of course they did. This is what he's paid for. He garners an audience who has a like mindset. The View garners an audience who has a like mindset. And if we tie into that, or better yet, you're going to hear a lot of liberals listening to Rush Limbaugh. No. Everybody's got their niche in that market, and that's what they're going to pull. If the ratings go up, you bet they go up, but based on that particular niche. You may talk about 10, 15,000, 100,000 people. That's not 300 million people.
Well, what the book does is it raises, the men who have read it have said their consciousness were raised, because the men that I talk to have said that, you know, have said things to me like, you know, they can hardly get together with a group of men and not have it turn into putting down women. And so that's a problem. And when we have boys putting down other boys by calling them a girl, you know, how's that a put down? You know, are girls not valued human beings? Why would that be a put down? You know, so there's an association there, and then they grow up and they have to unlearn that message that somehow girls are less.
If I'm on a football team with somebody, if I'm on a semi-professional football team with somebody, and I'm not doing the job, and I don't have the strength to handle it, and I can't perform in that area, and somebody says, you're doing it like a girl, that's okay, because a girl cannot perform in that arena. But if it happens everywhere, I hear what you're saying. But that's putting somebody in the corner and slapping a label on them, that's not a fair label.
Well, I would recommend that you not even do it in a situation where the strength would be a difference, because I think it's better just to, if you've got to put them down, then just don't use the girl as putting them down.
Well, we'll call it, we're starting to run out of time, Don. We'll call them a gorilla. That'll probably work. Don, by the way,
yeah.
website we can find you at?
KazarianCounseling.com.
Wonderful. And by the way, can we get the book there?
Yes.
Okay. Don, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Michael.
Good night.
Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice.
Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day.
Nick Tassler is with us. He's the author of Decision Pulse, How to Succeed in the Age of Uncertainty. He's a highly sought-after speaker. He's a thought leader, and he's an award-winning author, again, of The Impulse Factor. Listen to it close. An innovative approach to better decision-making. His work has captured the attention of high-profile business leaders, organizational consultants, and major media with straightforward and effective approaches to improving decision-making at all levels, both professional and personal. Nick, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's good to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, Nick, when it comes down to it, I really believe that a book like yours, there's a window of opportunity for it, because if you look at the economy, you look at the culture, you look at the politics, it is so confusing out there, and people are frightened to death to make a decision.
Well, and that's exactly right. I mean, on the one hand, decisions on making decisions is a complex chore, and it always has been since the since the dawn of man, basically. But as you correctly point out, right now I think we've reached a sort of fever pitch when there is so much complexity out there, and there's so much perceived danger and risk that what we're seeing now is people are so afraid of making the wrong decision that they make no decision at all. And that's really what the book is about, is sort of curing indecision first, and then worrying about, sort of counterintuitively, worrying about the outcome of the decision second. But just taking that step and actually making a decision, one right after another, to keep the ball moving forward in your life.
Oh, sure. There's two areas today, especially, where that can be an absolute disaster. One is in business, obviously. The other one is in politics. And if you're in business, if you're afraid to make a decision, you don't make the decision, you lose out, your bottom line goes, your return of investment gets shot, and you can't expand yourself to create jobs and on and on. So absolutely, it's going to take some tough people to stand up and say, this is the way it should be, and this is the way we're going to go.
Yeah, and another piece of that equation is I'm not advocating people go and what we need is a bunch of cowboys out there using nothing but gut instinct to guide their businesses or their country or even their own households. Really, what it's about though is sort of acknowledging the fact that no matter what, even with the most sophisticated software and all the world's best information and data. I don't know about you, but my crystal ball is in the shop, and so nobody can predict the future. And that's really when it comes down to it, what a decision is about, is it's sort of about how I want to position myself for an uncertain future that I really don't know what's going to happen.
A lot of that, Nick, has to do with being able to trust yourself. And when I say that, yeah, obviously, who knows what the future is going to hold, and who ever knew what it would hold, but especially in today's world, and what we see through the media, what we're listening to, and the many, many, many confusing, contradictory messages that we get. But most important, and I think it's one of the things that I'm looking at here in your press release, it's the motivation that causes that decision to be made. I think that, in and of itself, is critical.
Yeah, it is, and I don't know if you're familiar with the term positive illusions, but I think there's really which you touched on in the beginning here, which is what I call the illusion pendulum, and what I mean by that is in a time, say like the late 90s, when we were at the height of the tech stock bubble, we'd never been attacked by terrorists on American soil. It was really sort of this blossoming, and everybody was experiencing what social psychologists call positive illusions, which is just sort of this very natural human tendency to believe that that we're just a little bit smarter, a little bit prettier, and a little bit kinder and more generous than average. The only problem is about 70 to 90% of people believe this, and I'm no mathematician, but 90% of people can't be better than average, so that's why they call this an illusion. And those illusions were sort of widespread in the end of the 90s, and that's why Alan Greenspan famously coined his term irrational exuberance. Do you remember that?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Yeah,
and so that was true then, but what we're seeing now is the pendulum has swung all the way to the other side. If you flash forward 10 years, some psychologists at Harvard just in the last year have realized that these have done some studies to prove that the illusion actually goes both ways. So it used to be believed that we either had positive illusions or we had an accurate perception of reality. And what we know now is it just doesn't stop with reality. The pendulum swings all the way over to negative illusions where we believe that we're helpless even in situations where we aren't. So that issue of motivation and sort of confidence and a trust in yourself societally is at an all-time low.
No, sure. And let's take another word instead of illusion. Let's call it assumption. And who was it that that said the problem with assumptions, they have incontestable conclusions. You can't prove an assumption wrong. And people take them on as fact, and that's where the problem starts, because you're not living in reality. You're living in a fictitious reality that you've assumed something, and it has nothing to do with the truth.
That's right. You know, my grandfather has a more colorful way of explaining the problem with assumptions, but I won't share that on the radio. But you're exactly right. The assumptions are, and the fact of the matter is, we, to a certain degree, we have to have assumptions. That's how humans get through the day. Is we have to make certain predictions and estimations and assumptions about the world in which we live in, and again, how we're going to position ourselves in it. The problem is when these assumptions kind of go haywire, and they put us in a place that paralyzes us, which is what we're seeing right now.
Sure. No. By the way, this is something called control. You know, you deal a lot with, you personally, human behavior. Behavior is dictated by an experience. The experience creates a behavior. The behavior creates an emotion. And based on that, the emotion is how you're going to react. And there's too many people out there that are having experiences that are frightening them to death, and it's creating them to hide. And you know, you don't want to see politics anymore. You got the same thing on every channel. They're driving you nuts. So you turn it off and you don't want to listen. The problem with that is you could get hurt by not knowing what's going on. So it's a kind of an interesting catch-22.
Yeah, it really is. And that's why, I think that's why we're seeing so many people just sort of retreating and kind of almost hiding from the world, you know, going through their day, doing what they've always done, but really just kind of in the deepest parts of their heart and soul and their mind, they're really just sort of hoping for some kind of a hero to swoop in and change their situation for them. And that's why I think you see such heated debates about politics when people aren't withdrawing from it, is because everyone's sort of looking to, I'm helpless in this situation, so it's got to be Barack Obama or Mitt Romney or whoever your politician of choice is that's going to save us. And the fact of the matter is, regardless of what happens in the next election, it's going to be a few years before anything dramatically changes. And so it's really just up to each of us as individuals to sort of start changing our own situation. And the only way we can do that is one decision at a time. Of course, the rub is you got to make decisions to do that one decision at a time.
You know, it was reminding me when you were talking about that person coming into whoever it's going to be, Romney, Obama, whomever. It reminded me of, do you remember the very first Superman movie when Lois Lane fell off the building and she's falling, and Superman comes up for the first time. She didn't know it existed. And he said, "I've got you." And she looks at him and says, "But who's got you?"
right.
Yeah, well,
that's right. That's exactly right. That's such a great analogy with the Superman, because there is sort of this underlying assumption that somehow or another these world leaders or even business leaders have some kind of superpower that the rest of us don't have. And the truth of the matter is, they're just people,
yes.
And they actually can't fly with or without kryptonite.
Yeah, no question about it. And that's where the problem is. And I really believe it's how we respond to what we've been told. And this boils down to me as the average person sitting down, having breakfast at the house, and I'm getting ready to leave. Whatever goes on out there is really my responsibility, because in the end result, I'm the one who gets to vote for that person. I know we have an electoral college, and it's really them that put somebody in the White House, the top job, but there's all these other jobs, elected jobs, that it's our responsibility to do. And I think when it really boils down to it, it's not up to them, it's up to you, it's up to me, it's up to every individual to be able to live the best life you can and make sure that those people that you elect into office and their job is supposed to be, they're supposed to be the reflection of the constituents' ideas and attitudes and desires. If they're not that, they don't belong there.
Yep. Well, and I would even say one of the tricky things about politics and about the gift and the responsibility and the challenge of a democratic society like what we live in, is it puts the onus on voters like you, me, and all your listeners to go out there and take part. But it gets so overwhelming once election season rolls around and there's just so many different topics. And so what I recommend, which is really sort of counter to what a lot of people see as kind of the right thing to do, is you have a limited amount of processing power. And so the fact of the matter is you can't pay attention to 20 different issues and base your voting decision on that. You really have to shore up the one or two issues that you really passionately care the most about. It's called one reason decision making in the psychological literature. And you find that sort of one reason, and all of a sudden, the decision about who to vote for and who to give your support to becomes a lot easier. Now, of course, that does mean you're sacrificing potentially some of these other issues. But the fact of the matter is, when faced with 10 different issues and 8 different candidates, that is overwhelming for the average, even the superhuman being, to comprehend. And so what happens is most people just withdraw and they don't vote at all because they're so overwhelmed. So like I say, it's really key to just find what I call your decision pulse and start using that to guide all your decisions.
Okay, now let me ask you this, because I think this is an important question, and I think you're spot on for what you've got here. In the impulse factor, are you going to symbolically going to hold me by the hand and bring me through and so I can learn how to make the kind of a decision that's going to be best for myself, my family, my community, and my country?
Yeah. So you're talking about in the book?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So oddly enough, I would say, so there's two books. My first book was called The Impulse Factor, like you mentioned, and that was really just sort of an exploration of really sort of why do we make the decisions we do. But the thing is, and this is, I think, exactly what you're pointing to, I felt like at the end of The Impulse Factor, even though it got, it was acclaimed by critics and people liked it, I didn't feel like it was the book that I could just go and say, you know what, Michael Ray, take this book and this will help you all of a sudden become decisive. It would explain why you make the decisions you do, but it didn't have that simple hold you by the hand and help you make better decisions. And that really is what led to the movement that created the second book, Decision Pulse. And that one is very much, it has one goal and one goal only, which is to help people make simpler decisions so they can be more decisive and start getting through and really, really sort of creating the life and the job and the company that they want to create one decision at a time. And it does walk you through by the hand.
Nick, I absolutely love it. We're starting to run out of time now. So do you have a website we can find you at where we could get the book?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can get the book on Amazon, or you can go to decisionpulse.com. And if you go to decisionpulse.com, you can get the book there along with all the supporting materials. But the best thing about it is you can go on there and there's a free online assessment that will tell you what is your decision pulse. So there's about 8 universal values that are shared by everybody on the planet, and the important thing is to figure out which one of those 8 is the most important to you, because I'll guarantee you, you'll look at them and you'll say all 8 of these are important. And the problem is, to be a good guide for decisive action, 8 is about 7 too many. So you got to take this assessment and figure out which one is yours. It's absolutely free. If you do nothing else, please go and do that.
Wonderful. Hey, Nick Tasler, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, you're welcome. Have a great evening, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Okay, bye-bye.
I'm going to go my way by myself. Love is only a dance. I'll try to apply myself, teach my heart how to sing. Yeah, you can bet I'll go my way by myself, like a bird on the wing. I'll build a world all my own. There nobody knows better than I myself. I'm by myself alone. When you're alone, who cares for starlit skies? When you're alone, magic moonlight dies. At break of dawn, there is no sunrise. When your lover has gone, what lonely hours all evening shadows bring. Such lonely, lonely hours with memories.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Jody Chapman and Dan Tech up with us.
Never mean anything when your lover has gone. Work it out. Make me a world all my own. Ain't nobody, not in this room, no time, never, knows better than I myself. I'm by myself.
Jody Chapman and Dan Tech are husband and wife. They're authors of the best-selling Soulful Journals, books of questions that inspire reflection, growth, and gratitude. Jody's the author of the daily blog, Soul Speak, and as well as the upcoming book, Coming Back to Life. Dan's also the author of several novels and screenplays, including his most recent screenplay, The Mountain, a story about overcoming life's obstacles. Jody, Dan, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us, Michael Ray. We love being here.
We're so glad to share this.
Hey, thank you. By the way, I'm glad you guys are here because, you know, you talk about soulful journals. There are so many people that are frightened to death to look inside, and sometimes you need somebody to stand there and say, it's okay. You know, as human beings, you know, most people need permission to do so, which I guess stems from mom and dad, whether they did or didn't get it. But before you can start a journey outside, I guess you got to start that journey within, don't you?
That's definitely so true. Exactly. And it's funny, that's exactly how we got started. We used to make blank journals because we were such big journalers and we're both writers. And so many people would come up and would say, I'd love to journal, but I don't know what to write. So, you know, they would get intimidated by a blank page. So we would just give them a little nudge in the right direction. We'd give them prompts, even something as simple as our first one just said, I am grateful for, and they could fill in the blank. And then we branched out from there and created other books of writing prompts about different topics. But they all do stem from exactly like you said, starting from within, getting to know yourself.
Now, by the way, when the two of you put this together, what was the main impetus? What was it that sparked this concept, and then it became a reality?
Well, I think both of us, our entire lives, have gone within and made that sort of our default setting. That's just always been important to us. We both have backgrounds in personal development, just on our own, not even professionally, and so we just knew that there was a need for this. You know, that we weren't the only ones who felt pulled toward our soul. And so we thought, well, let's start it for us. You know, you always write about what you want to learn. So we started it for us, and the response has been just wonderful, and we're thrilled to be helping others as well.
Well, Jody, let me keep you on, and let me direct this question to you. And it happens to every author, and it doesn't matter whether it's fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, whatever the case may be. There comes that time somewhere in the writing, that aha moment, that epiphany, that cathartic moment, then you realize something about the subject matter that you didn't know was there. Jody, where was that for you in this book?
That was the first, I guess it was the second soulful journal called Journaling Within, and it was the first writing prompt book that we wrote. And it wasn't my intention originally to even write it. I just sat down and I had these prompts coming out of me, and the way I describe it is I was, you know, kind of a channel through the universe. And that sounds, you know, new agey and a little woo-woo, but it's true. And I felt like I wrote it in a half an hour. It just came out. And, I was taking dictation from the universe. So that's my aha moment. And I thought, this is what I am meant to do.
Yeah, Dan, don't we all have the universe inside of us and that little bit of a woo-woo, no matter what anybody says, it's always there. It's always there.
Well,
it's
absolutely. That's awesome. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was done.
Okay, absolutely, I was agreeing. We all have the universe inside of us, and like you said from the beginning, it all starts within. And we've experienced this in our own lives, and we know that so many other people, we're not alone in feeling alone sometimes, and so many people are just torn in so many different directions with this externally focused world. There's so many distractions between, you know, your cell phone's going off, and you got to answer email, and you got work and family. And just to take, even if it's just 5 minutes a day, and to sit down and have a place where you can reflect on your own life and your own thoughts. And it's exactly true what you said, that there's a time in any author's journey, and it doesn't have to be somebody who's a professional writer, where as you're writing, a light bulb goes on, an aha moment, where it might not even be something that you intended to write about or to think about, and something comes out in the process of writing. And for me, it almost feels like writing is thinking, and to give people a little prompt in that direction to get them started, we found is so helpful, and so many people have responded so positively, saying that it helps them to get the wheels turning and to get them in a different mindset or a different, more positive place than they were when they started.
There was a psychic that was on the show, I don't know, 6-8 months ago, something like that, a fellow by the name of Riz Mirza, and he had a quote that I kept the quote because I thought it was so powerful. And the quote was this: people, meaning him, people always ask me what happens after you die, and I ask them what happens when you finally live.
Wow, that's powerful. I need to write that down.
Well, that's wonderful. I can definitely relate to that. And, you know, so whatever people's belief system is, you know, that might be a matter for speculation. But the one thing that we do know is that we're here now and to explore, you know, like they say, the unexamined life isn't worth living. And I guess you could also say the unlived life isn't worth examining. So, you know, trying to find that balance between, you know, having the external life and actually living as fully as you can, but also taking time to go within, recharge, and to know who you are.
Yeah, I think one of the hardest things for anybody is to get right now into the present. You know, we keep hearing people say, you've got to be right now, you've got to be in the present. And I'm not a meditator, and it takes me sometimes in the morning and in the night, I'll definitely, if I can get 30 seconds of not thinking ahead or not thinking behind, then I'm fine. And each day it gets a little better. But the point of contention is we forget that we're here and we're now. It's what's going to happen in 5 minutes from now. What's going to happen tomorrow? What happened to me yesterday and last week? And last week's gone. There's nothing you're going to do about last week. And tomorrow is not here yet. And the only thing you have, if the place blew up right now, there is no tomorrow and there is no behind. And the only thing that you have is right now. And the biggest problem, Jody and Dan, I think most people have is they don't think that they have enough or they are enough. And, you know, it goes on and on and on. And for the moment you are, you could be as broke as you could possibly be. And if you were out in the middle of a park and you had 37 cents in your pocket, that's all the money that you could ever need at that moment, because there's nothing you could spend anything on anyway. You got more than you need.
That's so true. And I really relate to you talking about not being a meditator, because I'm honestly not either. I've tried it so many times, and I really wanted to be one, but it just didn't stick. And so I thought, well, let me see what works for me. And I think that's what's crucial for everybody who's listening, to just sit with what feels right for them. And for me, it happens to be writing. And I don't feel completely centered unless I've spent, you know, I spend probably 30 minutes to an hour a day writing. But that's not going to work for everyone, and I understand that. Some people might walk, and as they're walking, they stay present, and they think about the steps that they're taking. And, you know, it's just staying in the present moment. And what we always say is you can't go wrong with gratitude. So if you're in the present and you're feeling gratitude for what's right in front of you, if you're just standing here like right now, I'm grateful that we're talking with you. That's right here, right in the present. It didn't cost me anything, you know, and it grounds me. So that's what I would suggest to anybody who's struggling with being in the present.
You want a great exercise for being in the present? Radio,
yeah.
Susie's over there. She's, I know what you're going to do. Okay, try this out. You guys sitting by a desk?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, touch the desk. Go ahead, touch the desk. Did you touch it? The desk just came into being. Before you touched that desk, it wasn't even there, was it?
Mm.
Yeah.
I like that.
And realistically, I think, you know, getting into the present, what I've done when I find myself, you know, spinning off and quote-unquote multitasking, I just touch my chest. And it brings me right back into right now. And if you have to keep reminding yourself, then remind yourself. But that's really what it is.
Absolutely.
Unless you concentrate on it, there is nothing that exists in the world until you acknowledge its presence.
Brilliant, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And you keep reminding yourself. And I think that's what everything that we do is more so. That it's not that we're teaching this brand-new revolutionary philosophy, bringing something that's never been heard in the world, but just reminders. And for some people, it might be a writing prompt. For some people, it might be just, like you said, touching the desk or just taking a deep breath and just reminding yourself of the importance of your life and your experience in this present moment. So that's there's many, many ways that people can do that. And you know, we found the writing through journaling is great for us. Meditation or walking works for others. But there's lots and lots of reminders, and that's the key to
I don't necessarily journal, but I think journaling is absolutely great. Because when you sit down and you put something to pen, all of these great creative ideas come out of you that normally wouldn't have come out of you. And a lot of people, when they sit down and journal or they write, they get shocked with what did, and they sit back and they say, did I write that?
Yeah, you'd be amazed. Like you said before, there's a whole universe inside you, and it just wants to come bubbling out. And you just need to give yourself permission, give yourself the time, and to realize that even in this culture where it's not always valued, you know, it almost seems like you're wasting time. You're not being productive, you know, to sit and reflect and journal. But it is the essence of life in so many ways to be able to get in touch with yourself and to know yourself. And we've just found it's a wonderful tool, and I know for lots of other people it is too.
Isn't it about rhythm. And when I say rhythm, isn't it about getting into a particular rhythm? And think about this. When you dance, you know, obviously you feel the music, and if you're feeling the music at that moment, you are right there. Nothing else matters. And I would venture to guess when you're journaling, you get into that rhythm, that whatever that vibration is, whatever the language is, but it's that sensation of the moment. That's why when they talk about, you know, collective consciousness and everybody is, you know, joined together in one way, shape, or form, I believe that. I believe that because I believe that there is a rhythm. And if you're within the rhythm of the people that you're with, it's like the two of you. The two of you, you're married. You fell in love. And the only way you could have done that is if you would have both gotten to sync with the same rhythm.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's some people call that also the flow. And when you're writing, you definitely can get into that place, even within yourself or within elements of the world around you that or other people that you might not have been in touch with or might not have been aware that you were in touch with before you started writing. So,
yeah, I think it's great. Now, obviously, we've got about 2 minutes left, and somehow we didn't get into multitasking.
Wow, that went so fast.
Yeah.
Time goes by when you're having fun. By the way, we've got about almost 2 minutes to go. When we are dealing with multitasking, is that, and there's a question now, is that a way of not looking at your life and not concentrating and kind of hiding yourself and wearing this kind of mask so you don't have to see things?
I think definitely. I think it's a crutch to, and I definitely have been guilty of this throughout my life, where you think, I have to do all of these things, and rather than going within, because that can be a scary place sometimes. And so you
sure.
create all of these tasks for yourself, and I really just, it just comes back to going within and being grateful and giving yourself permission to look inside.
And you talk about rhythm and flow, and if you're constantly multitasking, going back and forth from one thing to another, it's next to impossible to get into a real rhythm and flow on any deep level. So that's another benefit of giving yourself the time to allow yourself to get into flow, to get into the deeper levels of your own consciousness and your own experience.
Oh, sure. And let's take that, you know, a step farther. If you've got five or six things going on at one time, you're deluded. There is no way that you could put full concentration and get 100% out of it.
Exactly.
Absolutely not. And not only does that diminish your productivity tremendously, I've heard, you know, estimates of, you know, every year and a half the economy loses $1 trillion because of time wasted with multitasking. But what's more important to us is the qualitative aspect, that if you're talking to somebody and on the phone and you can hear them checking their email or typing away, as this happened to us, or you're sitting there having a nice dinner and somebody answers their cell phone and they're trying to talk to somebody else and talk to you, I mean, you just feel less valued than when somebody really gives you their complete attention. And it doesn't have to be with another person. It can also just be with yourself. When you're writing or doing any activity with that single-tasking focus, then you can really get to a deeper place than you can if you're constantly flitting about from one thing to another.
I hear you. Hey, Jody and Dan, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
We do. It's soulfuljournals.com. And if people are curious, what sort of titles you have or what sort of writing prompts are you talking about, we have a free ebook that anybody who goes to our journal, soulfuljournals.com, can see right there on the homepage, the gratitude book. And we also have, for today only, special for this, for the listeners, for all of our journals, are buy one, get one free. So it's a great day to go and check it out, look at our prompts for free, and see if it's something that you'd like to pursue.
Wonderful. Hey, both of you, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
It's been so nice talking to you.
Good night.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Good night.
Gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these. Said some of these days I do it so quick. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing.
You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you whatever you've done, it's all over. Wherever you've been is so strange. Yesterday's long gone forever. Damned if what you're feeling.
Dr. Maynard Bresman with us. He's a consulting psychologist, executive coach, and a trusted advisor to senior leadership teams. He's the president of Working Resources, a leadership consulting and executive coaching firm specializing in helping San Francisco Bay Area companies and law firms assess, select, and coach and retain emotionally intelligent leaders. And Maynard, let's say hi. Welcome to the show.
Great, Michael. Thanks for having me. I'm all excited about being here.
Oh, hey, by the way, thank you so much for being here. There's a very interesting word, and it's called reinvention. And in today's world, especially with everything that's going on and all these companies that are going under and people getting let go, that word is such a powerful word, but I think most of the population out there really, truly don't understand what you can do with that.
Yeah, I think, even the word, I thought about that, even the word reinvention, a lot of times people don't even know what it means. But basically, I'm going to tell you a story that, I wake up every morning, even though I have this career as a consulting psychologist, executive career coach, reinventing myself. And what I mean by that is that every morning, I don't take for granted that what was happening in my business is going to be happening that day, that I have to be different, I have to be creative, I have to really keep my finger on the pulse about what could be potentially new and stay on the edge. And that's reinvention, that it's you're actually recreating yourself constantly. And so what you were, yesterday or today might not be what it is tomorrow. And it's having that type of agile learning type of mind in everything that you do. You have to always see what's possible that particular moment, that particular day, and what was true before might not be what you need now. And then if you think it's going to go back to the way it was, a lot of times that's a wake-up call for people, because that might be over.
Now, by the way, and reinvention is also, in many, many, many cases, and I would venture to guess, Maynard, that most people wouldn't get this, it's moving to another dimension of yourself. That's what I'm hearing you say. You don't have to become, from a cab driver to the president of the United States, in 3 days. But it's taking what you have also and taking a look at what's going on, because there's so many variables out there today that are so confusing to most people. Things are changing fast. And I think that word is very important, that reinvention every day. It's just maybe a little bit of a different twist on who you are, what you're doing, to match what you need to accomplish at the end of the day.
Yeah, actually, in a way, Michael, you might have worded it differently than I might have, but I think you really hit the nail on the head, that I think a lot of times, like anything is possible, but a lot of times people are always looking for something external. I'll tell you a little story. I was just at this International Coach Federation conference. I happened to be sitting next to an accountant, and she had reinvented herself to actually be a coach. And I thought it was really interesting. She said, well, I finally found it. And I started talking about, did you really find it? Or maybe the distinction is that you uncovered it. It was already within you. And I think a lot of times that really is true, that if people, part of the process that I use when I help people reinvent themselves in their career, a lot of times it isn't just you're going back to school or you're going to, you know, turn from a cab driver like Midnight Cowboy into a surgeon or something, but it's this whole process of really getting to know yourself and being with yourself and uncovering it from within. Very often, it's there, kind of like Michelangelo when he created David. It, what, you know, he talked about he just had to chip away, you know, the rock, and the sculpture was there. And I think that's true about reinvention. Very often, what's going to make you happy, what's going to be meaningful, what's going to be purposeful, you know, your values, it's already there. But we have such a, in fact, I caught the tail end of your last interview, and they were talking about our culture of distractibility. And very often, we're so distracted from self. And so this way to kind of discover, reinvent yourself, very often is as simple as spending time with yourself, but that's very difficult in our culture that is so busy.
Well, sure. And as a matter of fact, the culture is, you know, today especially, the culture at Maynard is so busy compared to what it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. There are so many more variables that come into play when you get up in the morning. You don't know what you're going to face when you walk outside the house. So I think to be able to truly get a grip on it, and you said it, you got to go inside yourself. And you've got to be able to, quote unquote, give yourself the permission to be able to do this. And most people are frightened to death to do it.
Well, you brought up a couple of interesting points. One is you have to give yourself permission. So you have to have, say, you know, make the commitment that you're going to give yourself time to do it. Okay, so that's one thing that's really important. Very often people don't do that. They just, you know, they keep staying busy or doing things, hoping that something's going to change. You know, that, you know, it used to be where people, oh, I'll go to Europe and I'll come back and things will be different. Well, I know, I think someone wrote that book, John Kabat-Zinn, wherever you go, there you are. You know, it might happen, but very often you come back and you've got the same kind of situation. The other thing that you mentioned that I think is really critical is fear. People really do, like today, you know, you watch the news, they're talking about, you know, before it was this question, you know, maybe one-third chance we're going to go back into recession. Today, I turned on CNN, and they're going, boy, it's almost inevitable. We're going to go. So people are getting locked up into fear, which is almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. They're creating this by going to fear. So a lot of the work that I do with clients to reinvent themselves is to help them stay positive, to build confidence, self-esteem, security, and to really create this, like a story, you know, that things are possible, that they can do this so that they don't go to fear. And that's what you kind of break through, the thinking, that the stories that people tell themselves that they can't do it, it's not possible, or the economy or Wall Street, whatever people tell themselves, you got to be really careful about that. And you also got to be really careful about, you know, I was talking with a CEO of a company about the fear that he went to with the two recessions, you know, one in Silicon Valley and the more recent one, and he went to fear and got depressed. And how that's contagious. So you can be careful about your own fear, how that's contagious to others, but staying around people that if they're in fear, that you begin to pick it up. You know, so you've got to, you know, shift into this more, you know, emotional intelligence, social intelligence state of positivity and possibility to be able to overcome and break that pattern before you get into fear, because then you're really locked up and then you're in trouble.
Oh, somebody gave me a definition of fear. I think it was like 1981, 1982. And the definition was fear is when you think you'll get hit back harder. You'll get hit back harder. Meaning that whatever you do, you're going to come up on the worst end of it.
I don't know who came up with that, but it makes sense. You know, the antidote to me is really, I think, to be able to thrive and, you know, make it, to, you know, today is more resiliency, you know, is more to have the mindset that rather than you can get hit harder, because that really creates, you know, something that's going to lock you up, you know. I think when you think about people that thrive or that are resilient, you know, they talk about Clinton, like the comeback kid or something. You really have the mindset, the psychology, the positivity that no matter how hard you're going to get hit, you're going to make mistakes, there's going to be failures, things aren't going to work out. But you're going to come back even stronger and better. That's the kind of mindset, energy, story you want to tell yourself so you don't get caught up in fear.
And it's got to be believable. It's got to be within the realm of what you think is going to be possible for you. And I think at the core of all of it, the core of all of it is that word mindset that you have. Let me give you a prime example. You and I are standing in a room, and you're standing with your arms locked at your side, your feet together, your ankles together, very stiff, very rigid. and I'm standing in front of you and I push you with a certain amount of force, you're going to fall back. Okay. Now, same scenario. You're standing there, you got your feet apart, you got your balance really good, and I push you with the same force. Well, you're not going to fall because you're balanced, you're prepped for it. And it's here is the, herein is the message. The message is, with a shift of position, everything is the same, but the outcome's completely different.
Well, I think that's, I think you're absolutely right. Whether it's your physical position, your mental state, your psychological, your spiritual, it all depends on the state that you're in. If you're locked up in fear, if your body's rigid, you're tight, you're standing, whatever, you're absolutely right. You're going to fall over and you're going to break something, or it's going to be hard to get back up. But if you're open, by the way, if you're smiling, it's very powerful. If you're making contact, if you're present, with people, people pick that up. I mean, that's what I think creates possibility. The other situation that you showed, I think if that's the way you're standing and that's the way you're presenting yourself in the world, the person you might want to meet, the business, opportunity that you might want, those things are going to they're going to pass you by like a train in the night, because you're going to be in that state of that where you're not going to be receptive. The other state is a state of possibility. You're smiling, you're open, you're excited, your energy's there, you're looking, right in the eyes of the person you want to talk to. Then I think things really begin to generate and happen. It's a completely different reality and way of being in the world.
And by the way, the operative word is smile. And I've done this for years. If I get really upset with something, I'll think of something soft. I'll think of something to smile about. When you smile, the old adage that laughter is the best medicine. When you smile, you release endorphins. Endorphins make you feel good. And it's a chemical change. And that smile can actually change your brain chemistry, which changes your attitude and what you're going to do in that moment.
Well, I think it's really true. It also, like in neuroscience, they talk about mirror neurons. When you smile, you entrain yourself with another person. So if we're talking about your career and reinventing yourself, if you smile and you smile at other people, whether it's, on the job or you're interviewing people or wherever it might be, people pick up on that, and they begin to kind of get in sync with you. It's congruent. So I think it seems like a simple thing to do, but it's so powerful. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if we get back to our old fear thing, if you're out there and the economy is, going bad and you're worried about your job and whatever, if you get locked into that and you're frowning or your shoulders are slumped, people pick up. And then your opportunities, very often you miss them because people consciously or unconsciously pick it up. So smiling, being in a state of gratitude, getting to a state, of happiness and possibility, all kinds of things can happen. Again, I know you have to deal with reality. I mean, you can't just, something horrible happened to you. Nobody's going to expect you're just going to smile if, your cat got run over by a car or whatever. So,
sure.
But if we're not talking about that kind of a situation, but for the most part, I think most people focus on the negative, and what I do in my coaching is suggest to people that they focus on appreciation and gratitude and what's going right. What do they like in their career? What do they like about themselves? What do they like about, their strengths and so forth? That creates the energy to create possibility to reinvent yourself, and that's the kind of place that you want to be in to be able to, to create the future and the vision for the work that you're going to be doing.
Sure, and then you're redefining purpose, and I really believe that's what it is. I think you were talking about the mimicking, the mirror neurons in the emotional part of your brain in the limbic system. I think a prime example of that is go to the movies. You've got actors and actresses right up there on the screen. They're reading from a script. It's not real, but they're bringing out every emotion possible in you. You're crying, you're laughing, you're angry, you're fearful. And it's the same thing. I think you're so spot on with that. If you walk in and you smile, they recognize something, and then they vicariously live your smile.
I think it's really true. And I also think, to kind of maybe move it further from smiling, and you use the word purpose. I reinvented myself, from working as a clinical psychologist over 25 years ago to doing consulting and executive coaching, leadership development, and it really is my purpose, and it's what's meaningful to me. I wake up every morning, and I cannot wait. I don't have a job. I just have work, that I find doing, kind of like the movies or whatever. You use that analogy. It's just a project. You do it and you move on to something else. But I have a deep purpose, something that's really meaningful to me. In fact, I remember years ago reading Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, you know, being in the concentration camp, one of the most horrifying kind of situations. But because he had a sense of purpose and a meaning to even write this book, it just allows you to create, you know, all kinds of possibility. So a lot of people, they're just, again, doing things. You know, they're going to work or whatever, but they don't really, and I'm not saying everybody has to be Mother Teresa and everybody has to have a purpose and something that's profound, but it could be anything. I mean, it could be, you know, knitting, or it could be whatever. But if you have something that really is at your core, your identity, your purpose, something that's really meaningful to you, I think it puts a smile on your face. I have a smile on my face. I never tell myself. I go to the local Safeway, and people are always saying, boy, I can't wait till Friday. That doesn't ever crosses. It hasn't crossed my mind in 40 years. You know, every day is a joy. Every day I just have gratitude for, because I have a clear meaning and purpose. And I think that is how you reinvent yourself. You really get to, what is it? Why am I here? What am I meant to do? All your energies are aligned. Your energy increases by having that. But very often people don't know what their values are. They don't know what their purpose is. They don't know what's meaningful to them. And then they keep reinventing the wheel, you know, this job and that job. And it goes after, you know, one thing to the next. But if, again, like I started talking about this, if you end what you don't want to be doing, if you really spend the time on yourself and stop being busy to figure out what it is that you really want to be doing, if you put the effort in, which is what I did, and go through this process, then every decision you make is filtered through that, and you attract, I believe you really attract work that you really want to do with people that you want to do, because you have a deep, you know, heart, spirit-led, you know, vision of what you want to be doing. And then life, I think, is really, you know, I mean, there's always ups and downs, but for the most, you know, is joyful and purposeful.
And every time that we're running out of time now, Maynard, but every time that there's a down, if you have the wherewithal inside, you can look through that down and end up saying thank you, because that down is going to give you something. You may not recognize it at the time, but after you look back after a while, you say, you know, if it hadn't been for that, I would never have done this. And with that, do you have a website we can find you at?
Right. It's www.workingresources.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Maynard, thank you so much for joining us. I've really appreciated you.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. Bye now.
As they say in this biz, that's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is what is it? What is it? You got to say it loud.
It's a wrap.
Thanks.
And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out.